I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times in Review. Last week's racially motivated shooting in a South Carolina church was a vivid reminder that racism still poses a serious threat to safety, stability, and unity in America. The alleged killer found out about hate groups on the internet, but real-world skinheads, neo-Nazis, and Klansmen continue to exist in parts of our country. We got a unique insight into why some disenchanted white youths are drawn to racist organizations when we were joined by Frank Meek, South Philadelphia native and author of Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Let's take a listen.
Well, you lived with your dad for a while in West Philadelphia, and then you ended up in Lancaster living with cousins. And that was really your introduction to skinheads, to neo-Nazi groups. But what was the appeal of those groups to you? And you were just a young teenager at this point.
Yeah, I was 14. Right. I just got out of going to school at Pepper Middle School, which is in Southwest Philly, and not a good situation, especially for a white kid, especially for like a kind of an alternative white kid. I was kind of a thug little skater kid. So I hated going to school there, and I started to hate the people I went to school with because there was just a lot of trouble all the time. It was mostly all black, and just a lot of fights, and the white kids were just, I mean, I remember we used to run to school, we used to run home from school. It was just not a good situation, and even at school it wasn't that great. So yeah, that summer I went up to the Lancaster area, and my cousin was in this stuff, and I remember when he first came in as a skinhead, and I looked at him, and I had seen skinheads being a little skater kid before, but they weren't racist skinheads. They were anti-racist skinheads, and they were like black skinheads and Latino skinheads. This group called SHARP, S-H-A-R-P, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. So I had seen skinheads before, and when I seen this whole neo-Nazi thing, I kind of was taken back a little bit. But I remember those guys would start talking about multiracial society will never work. And being 14 years old, I don't know what that means. But once they start talking about blacks and whites not getting along, I say, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And do you think, I mean, here you were a teenager, so you were still pretty young, but clearly a lonely kid, an angry kid, a disaffected kid, and not to use your life to talk about everybody, but it seems that that would be the profile of someone that might be attracted to some of these skinhead or neo-Nazi groups and might even be targeted by those organizations.
Well, the type of person I was is targeted by all the groups. I mean, really, if that summer, if I would have went and hung out with the people that were future left-wing guerrillas in Colombia, I probably would have been one of them, too, you know? It was anything that took me in and showed me love, basically, is what was going to get my affection and my loyalty.
And what was love? How do they show you love?
I remember when they all start drinking, and I'd be the little guy hanging out with the group, and they start handing me beers, and then they start talking about multiracial society again and stuff. And so they turn to me, and we start talking, and they start saying, oh, that's right, you went to school in Philly. Now, these are all, like, Morgantown skinheads in Lancaster. So these guys really ever been around black people. So when they heard that I lived around black people, I went to school with black people, they would ask me about what it's like. So they basically would be like, what's your life like? And I would say, and it's not, they didn't do it that way because these guys are only 16, 17-year-old. They ain't that bright neither to change me that way. But what they do is they just ask me questions about, how was school and how was life? And I'd say, it sucks. My school sucks. My parents suck. Everything sucks. And what it felt like to me, somebody finally asked me, how was my day?
Wow.
My parents never said when I got home from school, how was your day today? My mom never said, how was school today? And when I feel these guys were finally asking me, I liked talking about what was going on with me. And so finally we went to a concert one night together, and all these skinheads start getting in all these fights, and I seen that people were scared of them. People feared them, and they feared me, even though I was like this little 14-year-old kid, skater kid, hanging with the skinheads. And I loved that fear. I loved that people finally feared me because I feared everything. I feared going home. I feared going to school. I feared coming home from school. I feared if I was going to have food to eat. I feared this stuff. And now finally someone fears me, and I loved it.
You went to prison after you and some other guys kidnapped this fellow skinhead and really beat him up badly. And you videotaped it on top of that.
Yeah, we did that on Christmas Eve of 1992.
And do you know why you were beating him up?
I didn't think it was good that he came around because he was a SHARP. He was an anti-racist skinhead, and he kind of just hung out around our crew, which was not really accepted. And there was a whole little list of reasons that we had put together, but really, you know what? not one of them was really good enough.
And then you landed in prison. But curiously, and only because you said you were a thug at this point, an older African-American prisoner starts studying the Bible with you. You begin to play basketball with some of the other guys. And it sounded as if it was the Black and Latino prisoners who were nicer to you than the Aryans were.
For whatever reason, I was not connecting with some of those guys. I mean, I did on our beliefs, and I still hung with the Aryans every day because our beliefs were the same, and that was our family in prison. But the kids that I like to talk to were kids that happened to be like urban kids. Now I'm out in the boonies of
right.
Illinois.
Right.
So the bikers and the Aryans, you know, that's what they talked about. I mean, seriously, they talked about motorcycles most of the day, and I never even been on a motorcycle in my whole life. So now I would go and see some of the other kids going to go play sports, and the Aryans played sports too, but they weren't good, and it's not a stereotype, but they were bikers. So then they messed around and they played football, or they messed around and they were throwing the basketball around. I mean, they double dribbled, you know. I'm like, wait, this isn't how you play the game. So I played sports my whole life. I mean, I grew up in South Philly. I was actually like a star athlete in South Philly, which is, I mean, that's pretty tough, you know, and I was always the star athlete. Even when I was a weird skater kid, like I was the kid that was always picked first and always put on teams first and always asked to join teams first. And hockey, basketball, football didn't matter, right? So now I see some of the Black kids that were my age, a kid that I came up in the prison system with. We were both the same age. We both got up there. We were 17. I liked hanging kind of with him sometimes. It was kind of fun, and he was kind of a funny kid, and he'd always go play sports with the other Black kids, and sometimes I was just like, yo, let me play. I wanna play. And at first they didn't want to let me play, of course. I was a skinhead, neo-Nazi, you know, white kid. And then they seen how good I was. And that was that's all it really took in sports. You see how good a guy is, you want him on your team, or the other team's going to pick him up type thing. And I started playing with these guys, and they seen I had heart, and, you know. I play like I'm from South Philly, even though I was in Illinois.
Did you consciously at that point think, gosh, maybe the things that I've been thinking and saying about Blacks isn't true, or was that, or it was just strictly basketball, sports,
yeah.
Trash talk?
Yeah, strictly sports. The times that I remember that things would feel a little different was, I noticed sometimes I would share some stuff with those guys when we got done playing sports, or just even now that we started to know each other, we started sharing like intimate parts of our lives because we were young kids doing time, so we would talk about girlfriends, because you can't go to your older Aryans or your older gang members and say, oh my God, I have a girlfriend and I love her and she's going to stick with me while I'm in here. They're not going to counsel you. What they're going to tell you is that your girlfriend is doing things with your friends that you don't want to hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And they would think of it as funny to say these things to you because, I mean, you're not dealing with people with degrees in psychology. You know, these guys are just, they want to break your will, and it's not a whole big prison training camp where they're trying to break your will. They just don't want to hear a young inmate in there talking about how much he loves his girlfriend. So they would tell you nasty things, and you hate that. So when I started talking to G and I started talking to Jello, who were Black guys, about my girlfriend, I noticed they would always say nice things like, damn, your girl's going to wait for you, man. You're cool. You seem cool. And I was like, I hope she waits for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have a baby soon. And G almost had a baby on the way. So we had these same scenarios going on in our lives. And then finally my girlfriend did break up with me while I was in there. And it sucked, and I wanted to kill myself. Because I'm a 17, 18-year-old kid who's lonely as could be. And now even the thing I do love the most, I drove away because I was a controlling, obsessive nut, a horrible boyfriend. And G was one of the only people that would talk to me about it.
Yeah. Well, that's why they call them hate groups, isn't it? I mean, that they hate people. And maybe hate themselves, too.
Oh, I mean, they won't say that. See, the hate group, I know the lies. The lies are that they tell you, no, we're just proud of the white race. Or the Black group say we're just proud of the Black race. Or the hardcore, hardline Zionists say we're just proud to be Jewish. No, to be proud of what you are, you go and you put everything else down. That's not pride. That's, you know, that's fear and ego. That's what makes people hate. That's what makes people in hate groups. You have two components, a fear and an ego. And both of them have been harmed at one time or another. So now you're going to lash out. And you don't lash out by going out and doing community things. You go out by harming other people. Or you go out by demonstrating against something. And not to say all demonstrations are bad, but that's just what goes through these people's heads.
You include in this book something that Jessica, your girlfriend, says to you, you're not a race warrior. you're a thug. So this idea that you were a fighter for your race, really, as she saw it, and I guess as was true with you, you just really like to beat up people.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I had some issues. I have baggage, you know? When I come to a relationship, you know, when people say, oh, I come to a relationship with baggage, I come to a relationship with a U-Haul truck. I mean, I have that much baggage.
And Frank Meek, as you said, you and others who were skinheads or self-identified neo-Nazis beat up a lot of people, and the kinds of terrorism leveled on gays and lesbians. You want to speak to that?
No, I'll speak to that. It was widely practiced in all skinhead groups across the country as that gay bashing is acceptable. And I've never put the brick through the window, but what I would do, and I would happily do, maybe to make the amends, and not even make an amends, just to be a good human being, I would go down and help with a fundraiser. I'm not going to go down and say, hey, I'll give you $5,000. I didn't break the window, but I would definitely be supportive. See, because things that have changed in me is my whole belief in the religious part of this, and that, because the religion is what's so pounded to be anti-gay, and it's not, but that's where... That is so ingrained in our head. Even just normal Joe working guy, where when people say, well, what do you think about gays? Well, gays, God doesn't accept it. Well, that's crap, because the part where the Bible, and just to go on a little rant here, the part in the Bible where it talks about it's not okay, you know, the Sodom and Gomorrah, and if a man lies down with another man, it also talks about if you touch swine, you are, you know, sentenced to death. If you work on the Sabbath, you're sentenced to death. If it's okay to own slaves. So obviously there's some things that were wrong. And if you're a Christian, if people say that they're a Christian conservative, which is an oxymoron in itself, because that means you believe in Jesus. Jesus was the most liberal dude ever in the whole face of the earth. The guy hung out with a whore and prostitute and misfits. And he talked about the old ways need to change. So if you believe in this dude, Jesus... And you got to think that the old ways had to change. And that goes with all them silly stories that people must die for touching the skin of a swine and doing all. So the whole point of that is completely wrong. And if you want to believe in Jesus and you want to be, you know, accepting human being. So I don't think whoever my God that I have today does not care who's in whose bedroom. He doesn't care. My God only cares that I'm a good human being today on this earth.
See,
and that the next people I come in contact with, I'm a good human being too. That's all God cares about.
The word terrorism, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Anything that causes terror, it doesn't just have to be to a group of people. It could be to a family. It could be just to an individual. Is terrorist. I mean, you're causing terror in another human being. That's all to classify you as a terrorist. And that's what we did.
That was an excerpt of my interview with Frank Meek, South Philadelphia native and author of Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. He continues to speak around the country against hate, and he founded the anti-bullying campaign Kindness, Not Weakness. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll commemorate the bloodiest battle in the Civil War when we listen to my conversation with historian Alan Gelzo, author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. From July 1st to July 3rd in 1863, the most gruesome conflict of the Civil War took place in Gettysburg. We recounted that battle when we were joined by Civil War historian Alan Gelzo, professor at the College of Gettysburg. He joined us a couple of years ago to discuss the weaponry, the bloodshed, and the characters that played a role in one of the most important moments in the development of America. He discussed all this when his book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, was first published. Let's take a listen. So did soldiers and military leaders fighting at Gettysburg, did they know how significant this battle was or would become?
On both sides. Both of them realized that this was going to be a high-stakes encounter. For the Confederates, the war had been going into its third summer now, and the commander of the Confederate Army, Robert E. Lee, knew probably better than any other Southern leader that the Confederacy could not go a long distance. It didn't have the resources to support a long war. It needed to move quickly, or at least as quickly as possible, onto Northern soil, win a battle there, get the knockdown in the in the first three rounds, so to speak, and force the northern public to demand an end to the fighting. So what he was looking for was a military victory, but he was looking ultimately for a political solution.
He wanted to negotiate, I mean, in a sense, to attack Gettysburg so he could negotiate with the North.
Sure. If he won a victory on northern soil, in fact, if all he did was for 4 or 5 months in 1863 simply lead the Army of the Potomac, the Union Army, a merry chase around Pennsylvania, that even that would have serious political consequences for the Lincoln administration, because in the summer of 1863, the Lincoln administration is in serious political trouble. And the feeling was that if we could just push hard enough, Northerners are so sick of this war and its apparent bog down that they'll demand that negotiations be opened, and Lincoln will either have to conduct those negotiations or he'll have to resign. And once the negotiations are opened, no one's really going to start shooting again.
And was Lee emboldened because of victories at the Second Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, at Chancellorsville? I mean, they had had a string of victories against the Union Army.
Not only a string of victories, but a string of victories against every expectation and against the most daunting odds, especially just 2 months before at Chancellorsville, where Lee had, in fact, he had not had his whole army present. And nevertheless, even with one arm tied behind his back, he still manages to inflict an absolutely humiliating defeat on the Army of the Potomac.
And there was a lot of politics, it seemed, in who would be leading the Union Army.
Oh, goodness, yes. This was a very political war, for one thing. But for another thing, the military, our view of generals, our view of the military is today strict subordination to civilian authority. That's simply taken as an automatic given. And wasn't really quite set so deeply in concrete in 1863. George McClellan had been called to Washington in 1861. He created the Army of the Potomac out of almost nothing and stamped it with his personality and put his favorites into command positions. He was 180 degrees opposed to the Lincoln administration's policies. He felt, as a Philadelphia Democrat, that the Lincoln administration and the radical Republicans were as much responsible for the Civil War as the secessionists were. And the best thing that could happen would be that moderate-thinking, right-thinking, peace-oriented people like himself would finally get both sides together and they'd talk this whole thing out.
Well, he does tap General Meade, and he's, as you describe, pretty inexperienced when it came to commanding a military. And I think he was tapped just several days before the Battle of Gettysburg.
Well, this is true. I mean, he's inexperienced, I suppose, by professional standards today. Of course, in 1863, just about all of these generals were what we would call inexperienced. And the experience of most of these officers, like Meade, had been peacetime experience.
And why was he called or nicknamed Old Snapping Turtle?
Oh, my. He had a hair trigger temper.
Really?
When you met George Meade, two things struck you. First, he was very dignified. I mean, here's a Philadelphia upper crust Society Hill, before it was called Society Hill, Philadelphian. And when you met him, people said, well, it was like being introduced to a Presbyterian clergyman, you know, very distinguished, very, very lofty. And he was very nearsighted, too. So he always had this pince-nez hooked to the uniform jacket in front of, on the buttons on the front of his coat. But if you got him when he was mad, oh, boy, he could hose you down in the verbal equivalent of napalm. And people talked about Meade's incredible temper. Just trigger it, and you would be a very sorry person indeed. He would call you out in the most extraordinary language. There are moments, in fact, when he actually takes out after soldiers who are disobeying orders as he sees. He'll get down off his horse, and he'll slug them.
Wow.
So it's the kind of behavior that almost make George Patton turn pale.
But did that help hold the Union Army together?
Well, he felt that it did. He was contemptuous of most of the Union Army because he thought of himself as a professional soldier. Most of the Union Army and the Confederate Army, too, were made up of volunteers, which is a separate category, kind of an interim category between the state militias, what we today would call the National Guard, and the regular army. And the volunteers were kind of a mix of both. They had very little in the way of experience. Their officers sometimes had to give orders on the drill ground, reading them out of the tactics books.
Oh.
And it was sort of like, if you can imagine this, it was sort of like the chaos that you'd find in summer band camp, you know, when the ninth graders are getting introduced to a marching band for the first time. So you'd have an atmosphere like that, even though this is a war. Well, Meade looked at these people, and it just infuriated him. Their behavior was so sloppy, so undisciplined. His professional, aristocratic instincts rose up and denounced them.
You describe, as the Southern troops come over the border into Pennsylvania, the kind of, I guess, I don't know if we should be surprised by this or not, but the ransacking of barns for food, I guess provisions for the military. Also capturing, I guess, freed blacks who were living in Pennsylvania and taking them back south for sale.
It was something of a given in the 19th century that armies on the march like this would forage, they would loot, they would take whatever was not nailed down. In fact, it's not just armies in the 19th century. If you look carefully at behavior of soldiers in the 20th century, it's not really all that different. But in Lee's case, there were two things that were driving this. One is the fact that Lee had cut himself off from his nearest supply base, which was all the way back in Virginia. So his army really needed to feast off the bounty of Pennsylvania. But the other thing is this matter of kidnapping free black people in south central Pennsylvania. Ahead of the Confederate invasion, the vast majority of black people in southern and central Pennsylvania simply lit out for parts unknown. They would go north, they would go east, anywhere to get away.
Mm.
Those who did not, for whatever reason, were prey to be kidnapped by Confederate soldiers, rounded up, and marched off to Richmond to be sold in the slave markets. And the estimates are that perhaps 500 such people were enslaved. We have no trace of what happened to them. We don't know. They sort of just disappear off the pages of history. And I think one of the saddest blots on the record of the Confederate Army this way is its involvement in kidnapping and enslaving people in Pennsylvania.
Was that a direct order from General Lee himself, or was it more his troops sort of taking matters or the law into their own hands? Do we know?
Lee actually wrote two general orders governing the behavior of his troops, both of which had very stringent rules about paying for goods that were taken. Of course, the pay was going to be made in Confederate money, which was worthless. But at least there was some structure that way. He never mentioned anything about slaves. Yet those orders were issued, I mean, first of all, more with a view towards Lee's anxiety about the discipline of his men and keeping them in order. But secondly, they're mostly ignored in practice. And for that reason, the southern Pennsylvania countryside simply becomes great pickings for Confederate soldiers, people who objected to this, or other officers who objected to other officers that this was not in accordance with Lee's orders, got answers similar to that offered by one Confederate officer who, when it was discovered that his camp had a lot of sheepskins lying around on it, you know, his response was, well, no sheep can bite one of my men without consequences.
Wow.
So, yeah, there were all kinds of interesting excuses that could be offered, but the prime excuse is going to be the one that's offered for enslaving black people, and that is because black people are a valuable chattel commodity, and a lot of money can be earned from enslaving black people and selling them on those slave markets in Virginia.
There are certain things that I think I will never understand, and one is why soldiers will walk into a hail of bullets. And clearly, when you look at these or read about these 3 days, in many ways, that's what they were doing.
In the 19th century, combat was more like a very slow-moving ballet in which large clumps of individuals maneuver very slowly across comparatively small battlefields to get into contact with each other. The weapons technology, it was an improvement, let's say, on the 18th century because most of the armies are equipped with rifled muskets. But the rifle musket, yeah, it was an improvement, but it was not that much of an improvement. And it was still a single-shot, muzzle-loading, black powder weapon that kicked out these huge banks of smoke. So whatever improvements there were in terms of accuracy or range by the rifle musket, they're rendered nugatory by the fact that you can't see what you're shooting. After a volley or two, the powder smoke becomes so thick that it almost blots out the sun. And there's plenty of stories about soldiers in the midst of combat here actually having to get down on their knees to look under the fog bank to see where the enemy was. So it actually made perfect sense to stand up on a battlefield. You could do so with reasonable amounts of safety and to bunch people together, because accuracy is not the long suit of these weapons. What you have to do is to deliver fire by volume, not by unit. And you're trying, so that means you want to try and pull together as many people as possible in the smallest space to deliver the biggest possible wallop.
One of the arguments you make in your book, and I guess there are some that are saying that the Battle of Gettysburg was the first sort of modern battle, and you're saying no. This is 19th century warfare. This is not modern warfare.
I think a civil war is probably more like the last Napoleonic war than it is the first modern war. And I honestly think the best testimony to that fact is in Gettysburg itself, in the town. I remember sitting with my wife in the Pizza Hut on Buford Avenue one beautiful autumn afternoon, late afternoon, looking up at the sunset flaming behind the seminary building on Seminary Ridge, which was fought over during the war. Beautiful photograph, but the thought came into my mind, why is that still there? Uh-huh. Why wasn't that absolutely blown to bits during the battle? Because so much fighting took place right around it. And the answer was that these weapons, as much damage as they could do to the human anatomy, really didn't have a whole lot of destructive power beyond that. And they could hit buildings, they could shave buildings, they could pockmark buildings, but they didn't have the power to knock them down. So the kind of destructiveness that we associate with total war simply wasn't in the cards. They didn't have the technology to accomplish it, even if they had wanted to.
You also write, and this is interesting, and if you go out to Gettysburg, you see a lot of these post and rail fences, that this was a problem for the South, for the Confederacy, in trying to, I guess, navigate through Gettysburg.
One of the great things about living part-time in Gettysburg, as I do, because I'm kind of part of Philadelphia boy and part of Gettysburg boy, one of the things about being in Gettysburg is day in, day out, you get this sense of the lay of the land, what the land looks like, what kinds of things you expect to find on it. You read the accounts, you look at the period photographs, and you discover things. One thing which impressed me as I was reading about Confederate reactions to this topography in Pennsylvania were the fences. They were almost talking about the fences. And especially Pickett's charge, the two fences lining the Emmitsburg Road. Every account worthy of the name talks about the difficulty in getting over those fences. And it suddenly struck me, why were they obsessing about this? And it came to me later that they obsessed about it because it was so unlike the features of their own homes in Virginia and North Carolina. In the southern states, you have a slave economy which functions on large-scale plantations, and therefore the kind of fencing you use around large-scale plantations of 500 acres or more is comparatively thin, and you don't see too much of it. But you move into Pennsylvania. There's no slavery. There's no large-scale agriculture like that. Everybody's got their little 50, 80, 100 acres, all fenced in, triced up. And those fences, which were in their own way, their own physical reality, a symbol of a free economy and a free state, become this monstrous problem for Confederates to negotiate on the battlefield. It's almost as though the fences themselves, as these symbols of free territory, were fighting against the Confederate Army.
You write that it was really many of the junior officers in the Union Army who held off the Confederate troops, in many ways having to act on their own instincts or deal with what was confronting them on the battlefield.
One of the things that bothers me about a lot of military history is so often the sense you get that what you're reading is an account of two generals playing chess. And that, of course, is not what happens on the battlefield itself. Never has and doubtless never will. What you get at Gettysburg confirms that, because so much of what happens in the Battle of Gettysburg really turns on the decisions made by individual lower-level officers, sometimes all the way down just to the level of non-coms, who are looking at a situation, sizing it up, making a decision that they've got to make in the next 5, 10, 15 minutes. They can't wait for orders from on high, because with the limitations of communications technology in the 19th century, it would take a good 45 minutes to get orders down from corps level to a regiment. So these are people who just look at the situation, size it up, and make the right decision at the right moment and turn on the right dime and save a situation which could very easily have been the one that pulled down the center pole of the Union Army's tent.
It need not be said about the confusion and chaos on the battlefield. And General Meade talks about battles often decided by accidents. And that's probably true in a lot of battles and was particularly true at Gettysburg.
Well, I think that is. There are many moments you can isolate when the difference of 15 minutes, the difference of one person doing one thing or going in one direction, really could have tipped the scale entirely. And you almost feel like the entire future of the country was trembling in the balances.
That was my 2013 interview with Civil War historian and Professor Alan Gelzo, author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear my conversation with M.K. Asante, author of the award-winning memoir, Buck. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When author, filmmaker, and hip-hop artist M.K. Asante joined us on Radio Times in 2013, he had just published his memoir entitled Buck. Since then, the book became a Washington Post bestseller and is currently being adapted into a feature film, having received a Sundance Feature Film Program grant. Born in Zimbabwe and raised in North Philadelphia, Asante is also the son of one of the founders of Afrocentrism. He joined us to discuss his life and his book. We begin with Asante reading a passage from his memoir.
Chapter 1, The Fall. The fall in Philadelphia. Outside is the color of cornbread and blood. Change hangs in the air like the sneaks on the live wires behind my crib. Me and my big brother Uzi in the kitchen. He's rolling a blunt on top of the source, the one with Tyson on the cover, rocking a koofy, ice grilling through the gloss. Uzi can roll a blunt with his eyes closed. Cracks, splits, bust. The Ross Cruz and Philly are all three letters, he tells me. I read the cover through the tobacco guts and weed flakes. The rebirth of Mike Tyson. I'm not good. I'm not bad. I'm just trying to survive in this world. I do this. I spit lyrics to songs under my breath all day, every day. The bars just jump out of me no matter where I am or what I'm doing. It's like I got hip-hop Tourette's. Dumps, spreads, evens. JBM, Junior Black Mafia. Of course, us, UPK, Uptown Killers. PhD, Play Hero and Die, my brother says. Tears, licks, raps. HRM, Hit and Run Mob. EAM, Eriab, Mobsters. ABC, Another Bad Creation, my brother goes on. Folds, rolls, tucks. Another perfect blunt. John looks like a paintbrush. See, John can mean anything. A person, place, or thing. Sometimes if we're telling a story and don't want people to know what we're talking about, we'll plug John in for everything. Yo, the other day I was at the John around the corner with the young John from down the street. We get to the John, right? And the John, I was on his John, not knowing I had the John on me. Man, it was about to be on in that John.
That's great. I love that word, John.
John, yeah. That's, I mean, anybody.
J-A-W-N.
J-A-W-N.
Right?
I mean, anybody. True Philly cat knows that John is, you know, it's only used in Philadelphia.
Oh, is that right?
It's only used in Philadelphia, and it really can mean anything, you know.
And like a placeholder, right?
It's a placeholder, and it's also a way to have coded conversations. Yo, what's up with the John? We going to the John tonight?
Yeah.
What's up with that John? You know what I mean? What's up with that John? That could be anything, you know? And so unless you have context, you have no idea what someone's talking about.
Well, I love that phrase, hip-hop Tourette's. I mean, yeah. And it's clear from the book that you just have words just, you know, twirling around in your brain, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's not, the thing is, everyone I knew growing up had hip-hop Tourette's. I mean, we're walking down the street and we're singing Biggie lyrics or Jay-Z lyrics, or we're walking into class or we're playing, but everything we do had a soundtrack to it. So, yeah, hip-hop Tourette's, and it just comes out. You know, you don't can't even control it. I see grown men do this to this day. You know what I mean? Even me, sometimes I still do it. So it's something that is part of the culture. You know, you just have these words, and they kind of, you know, sometimes they guide you. Sometimes they just pop up, and you just think of a line, and you just say it. So
I should say that your father, Molefe Asante, I guess in certain ways the father of Afrocentrism, affiliated with Temple University, pretty well known person certainly here in the Philadelphia area. Someone you called Pops.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, we call him Pops. I mean, that's just how we grew up. It's like Pops. So that's the thing, too. You know, when you grow up with a parent who's well known, I mean, to you, they're always just Pops or Moms or whoever. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, that's my Pops. And the book talks about our relationship and how, you know, it grew and how it changed and evolved and was very painful at times. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah.
Well, and you talk about your house, your crib being mad Afrocentric. I mean, to the point where you didn't celebrate the 4th of July, you didn't celebrate Christmas, I guess, because of all the white Santas. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, those things were just, we just didn't do though. We knew, you know, everyone on my block, they called my dad Dr. Africa. You know, he wore a dashiki every day, you know. And when you're young, you really don't. And, you know, so much times, you know, when kids are young, you know, they just want to kind of be normal. They just want to fit in. They don't want. So when you're young, you're like, you know, Dad, why are you doing this? You know, why
are you embarrassing me? Why do you look like this,
right? Yeah, like, but you get older and you kind of start to realize what's going on with them and why they're doing that and his philosophy. And so, yeah, he's our house was always, you know, and my mom, too, you know, they always decorated everything with, it had a stamp of Africa on it, whatever it was. It could be coffee mug, it could be the casing for the light, you know, Everything had to have a little bit of kente on it or something. So
did they want you to sort of live that same quote-unquote lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they wanted me to know who I am, and they succeeded. You know what I mean? I know who I am.
You don't have a dashiki on, yeah. I have to say to her.
Yeah, I don't have a dashiki on, but I know who I am. I know where I come from. I'm proud of who I am and where I come from. And that's, I think, that's what they really wanted to do ultimately. I think the way they saw it is there's so much negativity toward Africa, toward, you know, even just black history, that they kind of wanted to overcompensate for that, you know what I mean? So that I'll just balance out, basically. So that's how the house was, you know? And I think, you know, there was some tension there in the book between my brother specifically and my dad.
Yes.
You know, just... you know, my brother just wanted to be a normal kid, basically. You know what I mean? And me being a younger brother, I'm just, you know, I was always the observer. You know what I mean? I was always, in fact, it was funny. My mom was talking to me recently and she said, you know, I never would have thought that you would have been the one to kind of observe everyone in the family and kind of tell this story. She said, I thought it would have been your brother. I thought it would have been someone else. But you were always kind of the observer watching everything. And I think that's, you know, as a writer, that's one of the characteristics that I have and I take pride in. It's just being observant and watching and listening.
Well, you do include many sections actually from a diary that your mother kept of this time. Yeah. Your parents split. Your dad sort of disappears. He actually goes and lives in Levittown for a while.
Yeah.
And your mom clearly has issues. I mean, she's struggling with what sounds like depression.
Yeah, she's suffering with manic depression. You know, she's suicidal at times. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was that's one of the things that, you know, in terms of my mom wanting to include these letters in the book, you know, that's one of the things she kind of wanted to open the door. Let's have this conversation about mental health. Let's have this conversation about mental health in the black community as well, because it's something that you don't hear about a lot. But it's happening, you know, and it needs to be talked about. And so, yeah, it taught me a lot those years about mental health and mental illness. And, you know, I would ask her, what can I do? I mean, is there, you know, and there was nothing really. So, but I later realized that what I was doing, what my brother was doing, and even to some extent what my dad was doing, was connected to her overall well-being. And so knowing that also changed my course a bit.
I mean, you sound in many ways like a typical kid. I mean, you didn't want to hear anything from your parents.
Yeah,
no. You wanted to do your own thing. You thought you knew everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, at 14, really, I told my mom, I said, I'm a man.
Yeah.
Just treat me like a man.
She said, all right. 14 years old, right?
Yeah, start paying some of these bills then. But yeah, I mean, no, I always have kind of, you know, from an early age, been like that. I think a lot of kids are like that. I think I took the independence thing, took it to the extreme.
I mean, it seemed like you hated school. I mean, there was sort of nothing there for you.
Yeah.
Sounds like you got thrown out of a couple of schools, or they certainly didn't want you back. But the street offered you something.
My story is about education. It's about miseducation, re-education, self-education, all types of education. You know, the difference between school and education, as Mark Twain talked about, you know, don't let school get in the way of your education. You know, so for me, dealing with these issues at home and you know, and then going to school and it being regurgitation and rote memorization and people who didn't seem to want me there, just in general, you know, it wasn't something I identified with. I never, you know, so I started to rebel against school. It wasn't interesting to me. It was, you know, I just kind of, and to some extent, I think that's a typical kid, you know, rebellious kid. But I think also there's something to be said about those schools and the way that they were kind of teaching and the approach, you know, to education. It wasn't something that I identified with. For a long time, I rejected school. And again, I think also when you have kids that are dealing with issues at home and then they come to school, the last thing they need from faculty and administrators is to be kind of tormented about it. They need, you know, at least some understanding.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was really there.
But you it sounds like you hooked up with a gang, and even at one point in this book you describe being given a loaded gun.
Yeah.
And you look at this gun.
Yeah.
You never used it that I'm aware of.
No.
A very good friend of yours was murdered with a gun. What did that, when, and here you are, you're a teenager with a gun in your hand.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you?
And there's so many teenagers right now with guns in their hand. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book as well. There's kids right now in Philly, 14, 13, 15 years old, with guns bigger than their forearms. I mean, right now. And I know this for a fact, you know, I've seen this. And, you know, yeah, I mean, what happens is when, for me specifically, you know, in that situation, when the people, adults around you and your brother and your family are away, they're not at home, I'm unsupervised, I'm just, you know, you start to identify with your other family. And for me, that was my brother's friends. They were all much older than me. So I'm 13, 14, they're 18, 19, 20, 17, 21. So I'm hanging out with them and they're treating me like family. They're almost treating me like how my brother treats me. But whereas my brother has the kind of cautionary element, you know, because I'm his little brother, they're treating me more like, okay, you're our little brother. Let's do some dirt. You know what I mean? Let's get into some stuff. And so I told my dad one time, he said, is it peer pressure that's, doing it? I said, Dad, look, if you see me getting into some trouble with some people, I'm the leader. Because I was
calling the shots.
I was telling them at the time that even though these people were around me and they were influencing me, I made choices.
But you go to this Creffield school. It's an alternative school. And you have a teacher. She gives you a blank piece of paper and says, you know, write something. And you write a kind of an expletive. And she says, you know, write more.
Yeah.
And that seemed it may perhaps the right time, right place.
Yeah.
Open the door for you.
Definitely. I wrote F school. And I really just wanted to be kicked out because I didn't want to do the assignment. You know what I mean? I was just waiting. But she didn't let me take the easy way out. She challenged me to write more. And I stared at that blank page, and it was like an ocean of white filled with possibility. And I started to tremble and get nervous and, you know, think about, okay, what am I going to write? And I'm looking at other kids, and they're writing, and I'm thinking, what are they writing about? And that was the beginning of this journey. And, you know, that definitely, that moment I can trace back is really what saved me in a lot of ways.
Let me quote something you write later on in the book. Writing is just like the streets. Don't hide anything at the beginning. Don't reveal anything until the last possible moment.
Yeah.
That's how you think about writing and the streets.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many. It's crazy because part of my education and what I'm so thankful for is, you know, to me, the whole world is a university, like from the beginning. Right. And so, you know, anywhere you go in this world, there's a professor waiting to educate you. And it doesn't matter where you are. It could be in a barbershop. It could be on the corner. It could be in a club. It could be a bum on the street. A bum on the street once told me, "Do you know what soul is, young man?" I said, "So like Soul Train?" He said, "No." He said, "Soul is the graceful survival against impossible circumstances." You know what I mean? I mean, that's a professor of mine. You know, there's all these people. So for me, being in the streets, learning so much in the streets, from street people, from outlaws, from people like that, it actually helped me do a lot of other things in life. You know, once you learn the language and the rhythm of the streets, it helps you in a lot of ways. You know, you see people like Jay-Z, for example, moving from the streets to corporate America, and he's able to kind of navigate that. And it's because there are a lot of similarities between, you know, the world is connected. Everything is connected. It's all connected. And so there may be a slightly different language over here, or kind of a different protocol, but there's a lot of connections between, you know, the storytelling that goes on in the streets and the storytelling that goes on in literature, or the ways that people move on the streets and the ways that people move in corporate America or in education. It's very similar. So I feel blessed to be exposed to that early on, because I think I've been able to use it in my career, you know.
But do you also think, because by the time you got to the Creffield School, it sounds like you were ready for something. A best friend had been killed.
Yeah.
You were starting to reconnect with your family, it sounds like, to some degree.
Yeah.
And then you discover Jack Kerouac, and you discover Walt Whitman, and you discover, you know, other George Orwell.
Yeah.
And those words, what, meant something to you?
Yeah, well, you know, the first book I ever really read was... when I was really young, like I had read some books, but I'm talking about that I can remember really, and that actually had an impact, was this teacher who gave me this blank page and told me to write. She gave me a book. It was by a dude named Jack Kerouac. And so, you know, I,
on the road.
And I peed the book. And I didn't know you could write about things like that. See what, you know, I'm a 16, 17 year old kid, and he's writing about, you know, drugs and orgies and the streets and jazz and all these things. And I'm thinking, I didn't even know that you could like write this stuff in a book, first of all. And second of all, I identified with what he was talking about. You know what I mean? It was like, this is what I was doing with my friends, you know, in Philly. So it's like, wow, this dude wrote this so long ago, but yet it's still the energy that it had to it, that rhythm it had to it. They were rebels. I've always been a rebel. I've always wanted to do my own thing. I've always kind of done things on my own terms. I always identify with other people who were like that. And it kind of just said, you know what? F this, you know, I'm going to do my own thing. And so reading Kerouac, even the way he wrote, breaking the rules. I mean, I didn't know at the time that, you know, you had to know the rules in order to break them. But, you know, these sentences that go on for three pages or whatever, you know, and not using commas and just this, and then learning the story behind that. I mean, I identify with, man, this guy is just, he's just doing his own thing.
That was author, filmmaker, and professor M.K. Asante, who would join me to discuss his best-selling memoir, Buck, being adapted into a feature film. He's currently on a countrywide speaking tour. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscone. Have a great weekend.